Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. To introduce Mr. Richard Wilbur, may I present the distinguished poet from Pittsburgh, Miss Sarah Henderson Hay.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me a great deal of pleasure this evening to be able to present to you the distinguished American poet Richard Wilbur. Mr. Wilbur has achieved that rare status of being acclaimed not only by a large and enthusiastic public, but by literary critics and his fellow writers as well. He has received many awards for his work, among them the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. He is an able teacher, professor of English at Wesleyan University. He is a scholar and a translator, and he continues to produce some of the finest poetry written today. In a time when, in pursuit of a greater freedom of expression, many modern poets have dispensed with traditional verse forms and techniques, Mr. Richard Wilbur demonstrates the fact that conventionality in form is not synonymous with conventionality of content, and that discipline in art is not in the least a deterrent to a wide range and scope of idea and emotion. He employs classic metrical patterns and verse forms, and he does it with freshness and vitality and with that virtuosity which, like all true virtuosity in art, has the appearance of perfect freedom and ease and grace. He can compress a large truth into a deceptively slight lyric. He has both profundity and wit, and he is literate and intelligent and intelligible. And he is contemporary in the best sense, in that his concerns with the things of this world are balanced by his awareness of mankind's universal and timeless affairs. And his poetry possesses, as Dudley Fitts aptly said in a New York Times review of his work, the civil grace and conscience of art handsomely controlled. In short, since you have so happy an experience awaiting you in hearing Richard Wilbur read his own poems, I shall not take up any more of your time in presenting him to you. Mr. Richard Wilbur.
Thank you, Miss Hay. I'm going to clear my throat by reading a number of translations first. And this first one is going to be my effort at a translation of Villon's most celebrated ballad, the ballad of the ladies of time past, the one that lots of people have had a go at since Rossetti first translated it. I realize it's brassy of me to come along after so many other people with a translation of my own. The chief thing I can claim is that I have been faithful to the perfectly ghastly rhyme system of the ballade, as no other translator has been. Another thing I tried to do in rendering this poem was to vary the tone of it just a little bit in the direction indicated by some scholars. The ballad, as you hear it recited by some Frenchman, or as you hear the English version of it said by some English and Americans, is often all of one tone. It's all ubi sunt, where are they, elegiac. And it sounds as if all the ladies asked after were of equal dignity. They're not. Joan of Arc has unquestionably high spiritual status, but the queen inquired after in the second stanza is no more elevated than Mademoiselle from Armentières. And as a matter of fact, the action attributed to her is apparently scandalous and fictional. You can't vary the tone very much within the ballade form because, as you'll notice, the rhymes come so insistently as to dominate the ear. Well, here we go. Ballade of the Ladies of Time Past. Oh, tell me where, in lands or seas, Flora, that Roman belle, has strayed. Teias or Ocupiades, who put each other in the shade. Or Echo, who by bank or glade gave back the crying of the hound, and whose sheer beauty could not fade. But where shall last year's snow be found? Where to is learned Eloise, for whom shorn Abelard was made a tonsured monk upon his knees, such tribute his devotion paid? And where's that queen who, having played with Buridan, had him bagged and bound to swim the Seine thus ill-arrayed? But where shall last year's snow be found? Queen Blanche the Fair, whose voice could please as does the siren's serenade, great Bertha, Beatrice, Alice, these, and Aremburg, whom Maine obeyed, and Joan, whom Burgundy betrayed, and England burned, and heaven crowned. Where are they, Mary, sovereign maid? But where shall last year's snow be found? Not next week, prince, nor next decade, ask me these questions I propound. I shall but say again, dismayed, ah, where shall last year's snow be found? I don't unhappily have any translations from Yevgeny Yevtushenko, who is coming here shortly, and whom it'll be your great privilege to hear. I've heard him holding forth at the Polytechnic Institute in Moscow to delighted audiences of bright young graduate students, and I did have a translator at my elbow to help out, but even without the translator, it would have been a delight and an illumination. I do, however, have a translation from Andrei Voznesensky, who's of the same generation, more or less. This one is called Dead Still, and it's pretty recent. And it comes out of the period, two or three years ago, I suppose, when Chairman Khrushchev suddenly lowered the boom on progressive artists of all kinds in the Soviet Union. And all the old Stalinoid critics came out of their holes and began to have their say again. And Andrei Voznesensky, headed for the Black Sea, and wrote this poem from there. And you can see that it's a poem written out of a distressed awareness of the cultural turn things have taken in Moscow. It's also a love poem. Dead Still. I did this, by the way, although I do have 27 and a half words of Russian, I did this with the help of Max Hayward. Now, with your palms on the blades of my shoulders, let us embrace. Let there be only your lips' breath on my face, only behind our backs the plunge of rollers. Our backs, which like two shells in moonlight shine, are shut behind us now. We lie here huddled, listening, brow to brow, like life's twin formula or double sign. In folly's worldwide wind, our shoulders shield from the weather the calm we now beget together, like a flame held between hand and hand. Does each cell have a soul within it? If so, fling open all your little doors, and all your souls shall flutter like the linnet in the cages of my pores. Nothing is hidden that shall not be known. Yet by no storm of scorn shall we be pried from this embrace and left alone like muted shells forgetful of the sea. Meanwhile, O load of stress and bother, lie on the shells of our backs in a great heap. It will but press us closer one to the other. We are asleep. Just last year, I think it was last year, maybe early this year, the finest Russian poet of the century died, Anna Akhmatova, and this is a translation from a poem of hers of 1920 or 21, which I did with the help of Olga Carlyle. This is the poem of a woman who came out of a full and great old culture into a new revolutionary hope and looked back toward that gracious and intelligible world she had left with considerable regret. And this poem is about that retrospective regret. Pasternak, in one of his poems, refers to Akhmatova as Lot's wife. And he's referring to this poem of hers. Lot's wife. The just man followed then his angel guide, where he strode on the black highway, hulking and bright. But a wild grief in his wife's bosom cried, "Look back, it is not too late for a last sight of the red towers of your native Sodom, the square where once you sang, the gardens you shall mourn, and the tall house with empty windows where you loved your husband and your babes were born." She turned, and looking on the bitter view, her eyes were welded shut by mortal pain. Into transparent salt her body grew, and her quick feet were rooted in the plain. Who would waste tears upon her? Is she not the least of our losses, this unhappy wife? Yet in my heart she will not be forgot, who, for a single glance, gave up her life. You can see at what point it ceases to be a retelling of the Genesis story and has to do with Akhmatova herself. Who would waste tears upon her? Is she not the least of our losses, this unhappy wife? That's all about her. Here's an absolutely unseasonal poem, which I'd like to read just because it's so simple. It's a translation of a rondeau, a famous rondeau of the Duke of Orléans, 15th century. This is the spring. The year has cast its cloak away, that was of windy rains and snows, and now in flowered arras goes, and wears the clear sun's glossy ray. No bird or beast but seems to say, in cries or chipper tremolos, the year has cast its cloak away. Stream, brook, and silver fountain play, and each upon itself bestows a spangled livery as it flows. All creatures are in fresh array. The year has cast its cloak away. Would that it had. I read poems here this afternoon, and some of you may feel as I do about things of this kind. If I'm writing to a friend in Ohio and to a friend in Florida, even though I know they're not going to compare the letters, I hesitate to say the same thing over again. And so if you see me hesitating and looking evasive, it's because I'm trying to avoid doing just the same thing that I did this afternoon. I think I'll start tonight with my own poems, with something I didn't read this afternoon, a poem called The Pardon. I remember how old I was when I wrote this. I was 30 because it was 20 years, I was writing about something 20 years old. When I was 10, my dog was killed, and to make the story very short, I knew where he was, pretended not to find him, didn't have the courage to go out and bury him myself, let my father do it, and felt guilty about it, of course, ever after. Or at any rate for 20 years after. When I was 30 years old, I had a dream in which at last I had the guts to walk into the little grove of pine and honeysuckle where the dead dog was. And he came forward to me in the dream and nuzzled my hand. He couldn't lick my hand because of his degree of decomposition. And I felt pardoned by the dog. And I woke up feeling terribly puzzled as to whether I could conceivably have been pardoned or not. And this poem doesn't answer that question. It's what Lord Jim is all about, isn't it? The Pardon. My dog lay dead 5 days without a grave in the thick of summer, hid in a clump of pine and a jungle of grass and honeysuckle vine. I, who had loved him while he kept alive, went only close enough to where he was to sniff the heavy honeysuckle smell, twined with another odor heavier still, and hear the flies' intolerable buzz. Well, I was 10 and very much afraid. In my kind world, the dead were out of range, and I could not forgive the sad or strange in beast or man. My father took the spade and buried him. Last night I saw the grass slowly divide. It was the same scene, but now it glowed a fierce and mortal green, and saw the dog emerging. I confess I felt afraid again, but still he came in the carnal sun, clothed in a hymn of flies, and death was breeding in his lively eyes. I started in to cry and call his name, asking forgiveness of his tongueless head. I dreamt the past was never past redeeming. But whether this was false or honest dreaming, I beg death's pardon now and mourn the dead. You see, I meant the word tongueless to be quite literal. Here's one I haven't read in ages, and I'd like to try it. It's called The Mill, and it's about an actual person I knew, about something he told me just before he died. The spoiling daylight inched along the bar top, orange and cloudy, slowly igniting lint, and then that glow was gone, and still your voice, serene with failure and with the ease of dying, rose from the shades that more and more became you. Turning among its images, your mind produced the names of streets, the exact look of lilacs 19-3 in Cincinnati. Random, as if your testament were made, the round sums all bestowed, and now you spent your pocket change so as to be rid of it. Or was it that you half hoped to surprise your dead life's sound and sovereign anecdote? What I remember best is the wrecked mill you stumbled on in Tennessee, or was it somewhere down in Brazil? It slips my mind already. But there it was in a still valley far from the towns. No road or path came near it. If there had been a clearing, now it was gone, and all you found amidst the choke of green was three walls standing, hurdled by great vines and thatched by height on height of hushing leaves. But still the mill wheel turned, its crazy buckets creaking and lumbering out of the clogged race and sounding, as you said, as if you'd found time all alone and talking to himself in his eternal rattle. How should I guess where they are gone to, now that you are gone, those fading streets and those most fragile lilacs, those fragmentary views, those times of day. All that I can be sure of is the mill wheel. It turns and turns in my mind, over and over. Mr. Theodore Hazlitt and I were talking today about how nice it would be to put fountains everywhere in all our cities, you know. It's the one really coercive thing I'd like to do. I'd like to force fountains on everybody. I read this poem in honor of our agreement. It's called A Baroque Wall Fountain in the Villa Chiara. I think it's the longest poem I've ever written, yet it's not very long. It's a description of a wall fountain in one of the public parks of Rome, a park called the Villa Chiara. It used to be called the Villa Wurz, horrible name, Villa Wurz, before, you know, Mrs. Wurz gave it to Mussolini. It's the only park in Rome, I'm sure the only place in Rome, where you can find artificial ruins. Can you think of anything so unnecessary? But this fountain in itself was very, very beautiful. I was living at the American Academy, or near it at any rate, playing pool there at the time. And my art historian friends were very scornful of my love of this fountain. They said it was of no art historical interest. But I became so fond of it, walking past it every day from my apartment to work in my study at the American Academy, that I began to describe it. And I think I've left nothing out of it. I describe it from top to bottom here. And then I go across the city of Rome and describe my way up and down the famous fountains in St. Peter's Square, all the time talking about the ideas of pleasure and joy and their relative dignity. I suppose I may as well, I object to explaining poems too much or talking too much about them, but I may as well say that one thing I was trying to do in this poem, one thing I was moved to do, was to give pleasure a fair shake for a change. People are forever comparing pleasure to joy, you know, and looking down on pleasure. Under the bronze crown too big for the head of the stone cherub whose feet a serpent has begun to eat, sweet water brims a cockle and braids down past spattered mosses, breaks on the tipped edge of a second shell, and fills the massive third below. It spills in threads then from the scalloped rim, and makes a scrim or summery tent for a fawn menage and their familiar goose. Happy in all that ragged, loose collapse of water, its effortless descent and flatteries of spray, the stocky god upholds the shell with ease, watching about his shaggy knees the goatish innocence of his babes at play. His faunus all the while leans forward slightly into a clambering mesh of water lights, her sparkling flesh in a secular ecstasy, her blinded smile bent on the sand floor of the trefoil pool, where ripple shadows come and go in swift reticulum, more addling to the eye than wine, and more interminable to thought than pleasure's calculus. Yet since this all is pleasure, flash, and waterfall, must it not be too simple? Are we not more intricately expressed in the plain fountains that Moderna set before St. Peter's? The main jet struggling aloft until it seems at rest in the act of rising, until the very wish of water is reversed, that heaviness born up to burst in a clear, high, cavorting head, to fill with blaze, and then in gauze delays, in a gnat-like shimmering, in a fine illumined version of itself, decline, and patter on the stones its own applause. If that is what men are or should be, If those water saints display the pattern of our arete, what of these showered fawns in their bizarre, spangled, and plunging house? They are at rest in fullness of desire for what is given. They do not tire of the smart of the sun, the pleasant water douse, and riddled pool below. Reproving our disgust and our ennui with humble insatiety. Francis, perhaps, who lay in sister snow before the wealthy gate, freezing and praising, might have seen in this no trifle but a shade of bliss, that land of tolerable flowers, that state as near and far as grass, where eyes become the sunlight and the hand is worthy of water, the dreamt land toward which all hungers leap, all pleasures pass. Father Clark spoke of this little translation, and so I'm going to read it. This is a translation from an Anglo-Norman bestiary of, I don't know, 12th century, let's say. I've got it wrong, but I forget. It's one way or the other, a little bit. It's a translation of a bestiary poem by Philippe de Town, and it has the usual structure of the bestiary poem. You start out with a little dubious natural history, and then there's some dubious explanation of the animal's name after the fashion of Saint Isidore, and then some particular bit of the animal's behavior is given a moral or religious meaning. Pelicanus is the word for a certain breed of bird who truly is a crane. Egypt is his domain. There are two kinds thereof. Near to the Nile they live. One of them dwells in the flood. The fishes are his food. The other lives in the isles on lizards, crocodiles, serpents, and stinking creatures, and beasts of evil nature. In Greek his title was Onokrotolos, which is longum rostrum, said in the Latin tongue instead, or long beak in our own. Of this bird it is known that when he comes to his young, they being grown and strong, and does them kindly things, and covers them with his wings, the little birds begin fiercely to peck at him. They tear at him and try to blind their father's eye. He falls upon them then and slays them with great pain, then goes away for a spell, leaving them where they fell. On the third day he returns, and thereupon he mourns, feeling so strong a woe to see the small birds so that he strikes his breast with his beak until the blood shall leak. And when the coursing blood spatters his lifeless brood, such virtue does it have that once again they live. Know that this pelican signifies Mary's son. The little birds are men restored to life again from death by that dear blood shed for us by our God. Now learn one meaning more, revealed by holy lore. Know why the small birds try to peck their father's eye, who turns on them in wrath and puts them all to death. Men who deny the light would blind God's blazing sight, but on such people all his punishment will fall. This is the meaning I find. Now bear it well in mind. And Mr. Hazo asked me to read this translation, and I'm delighted to do so. This is a translation from Francis Jammes, French poet of the 19th and 20th centuries, one of those on whom Jacques Maritain placed great hopes for a revival of Christian poetry. He wrote a lot of poems about donkeys, and this is, for my taste, the best of them, and certainly the riskiest, the most perilous. Poetically, at every moment it threatens to become too ridiculous or too touching, but it comes out all right. When I must come to you, O my God, I pray it be some dusty roaded holiday, And even as in my travels here below, I beg to choose by what road I shall go to paradise, where the clear stars shine by day. I'll take my walking stick and go my way, and to my friends the donkeys I shall say, I am Francis Jean, and I'm going to paradise, for there is no hell in the land of the loving God. And I'll say to them, come, sweet friends of the blue skies, poor creatures who with a flap of the ears or a nod of the head shake off the buffets, the bees, the flies. Let me come with these donkeys, Lord, into your land, these beasts who bow their heads so gently and stand with their small feet joined together in a fashion utterly gentle, asking your compassion. I shall arrive, followed by their thousands of ears, followed by those with baskets at their flanks, by those who lug the carts of mountebanks or loads of feather dusters and kitchen wares, by those with humps of battered water cans, by bottle-shaped she-asses who halt and stumble, by those tricked out in little pantaloons to cover their wet blue galls, where flies assemble in whirling swarms, making a drunken hum. Dear God, let it be with these donkeys that I come, and let it be that angels lead us in peace to leafy streams where cherries tremble in air, sleek as the laughing flesh of girls. And there in that haven of souls, let it be that leaning above your divine waters, I shall resemble these donkeys, whose humble and sweet poverty will appear clear in the clearness of your eternal love. This one is called A Voice from Under the Table, and it's a dramatic poem. At least first and last, it's a dramatic poem, spoken by a person of the type indicated in the title. I owe a couple of lines here to my friend Robert Brooks, who knows Greek as I do not. They're lines from the Greek poet Archilochus. When I read the lines which begin, "A myrtle shoot in hand," that's Archilochus speaking. How shall the wine be drunk or the woman known? I take this world for better or for worse. But seeing rose carafes conceive the sun, my thirst conceives a fierier universe. And then I toast the birds in the burning trees that chant their holy lucid drunkenness. I swallowed all the phosphorus of the seas before I fell into this low distress. You upright people all remember how love drove you first to the woods, and there you heard the loose-mouthed wind complaining, thou and thou. My gawky limbs were shuddered by the word. Most of it since was nothing but charades to spell that hankering out and make an end. But the softest hands against my shoulder blades only increased the crying of the wind. For this the goddess rose from the Midland sea and stood above the famous wine-dark wave to ease our drought with clearer mystery and be a south to all our flights of love. And down by the selfsame water I have seen a blazing girl with skin like polished stone splashing until a far-out breast of green arose and with a rose contagion shone. A myrtle shoot in hand she danced, her hair cast on her back and shoulders a moving shade. Was it some hovering light that showed her fair? Was it of chafing dark that light was made? Perhaps it was Archilochus' fantasy, or that his saying sublimed the thing he said. All true enough, and true as well that she was beautiful and danced and is now dead. Helen was no such high discarnate thought as men in dry symposia pursue, but was as bitterly fugitive, not to be caught by what men's arms in love or fight could do. Groan in your cell, rape Troy with sword and flame, the end of thirst exceeds experience. A devil told me it was all the same whether to fail by spirit or by sense. God keep me a damned fool, nor charitably receive me into his shapely resignations. I am a sort of martyr, as you see, a horizontal monument to patience. The calves of waitresses parade about my helpless head upon this sodden floor. Well, I am down again, but not yet out. Oh, sweet frustrations, I shall be back for more. Here's a tiny poem about the happiness of the closed mind, which I describe in terms of the well-known radar system of the bat. Actually, the last line represents an escape. Mind. Mind in its purest play is like some bat that beats about in caverns all alone, contriving by a kind of senseless wit not to conclude against a wall of stone. It has no need to falter or explore. Darkly it knows what obstacles are there, and so may weave and flitter, dip and soar in perfect courses through the blackest air. And has this simile a like perfection? The mind is like a bat, precisely, save that in the very happiest intellection, a graceful error may correct the cave. There's a little poem that's a love song, really, a love poem. But it's also a poem about the way certain architectural formations can oblige you to behave this way or that. The poem is called Piazza di Spagna, Early Morning. And I imagine everybody knows that most popular of squares in Rome. It's not full of tourists at the time of this poem. The occasion of this poem is something like 3 o'clock in the morning. All the tourists are asleep in the Hotel Hassler. The flower vendors have gone home. And there's just one girl responding spontaneously to the great sweep of marble stairs that goes down into the square. Toward that little fountain, which is either a candlestick or a candle holder or a boat, I never figured out which. Piazza di Spagna, early morning. I can't forget how she stood at the top of that long marble stair, amazed, and then with a sleepy pirouette went dancing slowly down to the fountain quieted square. Nothing upon her face but some impersonal loneliness, not then a girl, but as it were a reverie of the place, a called for falling glide and whirl, as when a leaf, petal, or thin chip is drawn to the falls of a pool and, circling a moment above it, rides on over the lip, perfectly beautiful, perfectly ignorant of it. This next takes its title from St. Augustine. Love calls us to the things of this world. And I talk too much before I read this poem. I'll say simply that you're waking up and looking out your window, and there's the first laundry of the day. What has wakened you is the squeak of the pulleys of the laundry lines. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance." Here's a little poem which really is seasonal. It's in two parts. It's called Two Quatrains for First Frost. Hot summer has exhausted her intent to the last rose and roundelay and seed. No leaf has changed, and yet these leaves now read like a love letter that's no longer meant. Two. Now on all things is the dull, restive mood of some rich gambler who in quick disdain plumps all on zero, hoping so to gain fresh air, light pockets, and his solitude. There were so many... Oh, dear. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a tolerable word for young people? I can't stand that expression. What... youths and maids, what shall we say? But there were so many young people here this afternoon that I didn't read this. But I will read it now just to show that I, too, am capable of bad taste. I'm working right now on a second musical show, and a musical adaptation of... Giraudoux's The Madwoman of Chaillot. But there's nothing... I don't have any lyrics that sound like much without the music. I don't suppose they should, really. I do, however, have one lyric from my first venture into this sort of thing back in 1956, the show Candide, for which Miss Hellman wrote the book and Mr. Bernstein wrote the music. And some unfortunate people paid about $500,000, which they didn't get back. This lyric I'm about to read you was the best one I wrote for the show, and it didn't survive the Boston opening. And there were various explanations for this, but chiefly it was because it was detachable from the show and we were running too long. It comes at the moment in the show, as in Voltaire's novel, where Candide rediscovers his old master, Dr. Pangloss, and says to him, he finds him alive, you know, he's thought him dead, and he finds him also suffering from venereal disease. And he says to him, "Dear Dr. Pangloss, you told us that everything was for the best in this best of all possible worlds. How can your present condition be for the best?" To which Dr. Pangloss, in a sort of muzzy, professorial voice, sings this rationalizing reply. "Dear boy, you will not hear me speak with sorrow or with rancor of what has paled my rosy cheek and blasted it with canker. 'Twas love, great love, that did the deed through nature's gentle laws, and how should ill effects proceed from so divine a cause? Sweet honey comes from bees that sting, as you are well aware. To one adept in reasoning, whatever pains disease may bring are but the tangy seasoning to love's delicious fare." It is a little rough, actually. But at least I can say about this second stanza that it is a straight paraphrase of Voltaire. Columbus and his men, they say, conveyed the virus hither, whereby my features rot away and vital powers wither. Yet had they not traversed the seas and come infected back, why, think of all the luxuries that modern life would lack. All bitter things conduce to sweet, as this example shows. Without the little spirochete, we'd have no chocolate to eat, nor would tobacco's fragrance greet the European nose. Each nation guards its native land with cannon and with sentry. Inspectors look for contraband at every port of entry, yet nothing can prevent the spread of love's divine disease. It rounds the world from bed to bed as pretty as you please. Men worship Venus everywhere, as plainly may be seen. The decorations which I bear are nobler than the Croix de Guerre and gained in service of our fair and universal queen. Miss Hay suggested that I read a rather crazy poem called A Hole in the Floor. I dedicated this poem to René Magritte, who was sometimes described as a surrealist, sometimes as a magic realist. I've never been sure what the difference was, but I've always liked his painting a great deal. This poem is not an effort to describe a Magritte painting at all, but once I'd written the poem, it struck me that the particular discomfort it gave me was similar to the discomfort I sometimes get from looking at Magritte. Magritte will paint with horrendous exactitude the interior of a room, you know, with every last rose in the wallpaper rendered and every bit of grain in the wood of the floor. And then there'll just be a hole going through the wall into the intense inane. Perhaps a blue out there, maybe a little bit of cloud. But it's an utter disruption, a violent disruption of one's sense of the familiar. And he so often plays just this trick. And it happens to us all whenever somebody comes in and tears up a hole in the living room. And that's what this poem is about. The carpenters made a hole in the parlor floor, and I'm standing staring down into it now at 4 o'clock in the evening, as Schliemann stood when his shovel knocked on the crowns of Troy. A clean-cut sawdust sparkles on the gray, shaggy laths, and here is a cluster of shavings from the time when the floor was laid. They are silvery gold, the color of Hesperian apple parings. Kneeling, I look in under where the joists go into hiding, a pure street, faintly littered with bits and strokes of light, enters the long darkness where its parallels will meet. The radiator pipe rises in middle distance like a shuttered kiosk standing where the only news is night. Here it's not painted green, as it is in the visible world. For God's sake, what am I after? Some treasure or tiny garden, or that untrodden place, the house's very soul, where time has stored our footbeats and the long skein of our voices? Not these, but the buried strangeness which nourishes the known, that spring from which the floor lamp drinks now a wilder bloom, inflaming the damask love seat and the whole dangerous room. I think I'd like to read something from my translation of Molière's Tartuffe now. I gather that a number of people here will perhaps have seen Bill Ball's production of it, and that made me think perhaps I shouldn't read from my translation of Tartuffe, but several people have said that it might prove interesting if I read it in a different voice, and perhaps with a different interpretation. I think very highly of Bill Ball as a director. I think he has wonderful theatrical sense. I differed with him diametrically on the interpretation of the play. Let me read a few speeches from this translation, such passages as I can handle all alone. Before I do it, I had better remind everybody of who the characters are and what the situation is. A main point of difference between Mr. Ball and me was that he felt Tartuffe was or could be treated as the central figure in the play. I don't think that's so at all. Tartuffe's a terribly simple character. The central figure is Orgon, an oddly troubled middle-aged businessman. One doesn't know just what's got into him. Sometime, shortly before the play begins, he's gone off his rocker slightly. My guess about it is that he's suffering, the French call it, the démon du midi, you know. It's a middle-aged panic, the feeling that life's getting away from you, that your powers are failing. And it's likely to lead to all sorts of things. In the case of Orgon, it leads to a kind of sadism toward those around him who are still capable of life and pleasure. And it leads to a very suspicious kind of religiosity. One day, while Orgon is at church, he is spotted by a phony with a terribly long and varied criminal record, whose name is Tartuffe. And Tartuffe adjusts his method to the sucker and persuades Orgon that he is a pious man. And Orgon at once begins to bestow money on him. And it isn't long before Orgon has brought him home and established him in the house as a kind of confessor, moral advisor, and censor, moral censor, as well as privileged guest. Everybody in the family, except for Orgon's silly old bigoted mother, Madame Pernel, everybody in the family is horrified by this development. And they all see through Tartuffe and see that he's not really a holy man, that he's a phony, that he's a swindler. Orgon's wife is his second wife, and that's important. A lot of people don't pay enough attention to that. She's much younger than he, and that's perhaps one source of his unease. She's an excellent woman, cool and warm in all the right ways, who knows how to handle any social situation, the sort of woman people like to drop in on for tea. And this is much resented by her husband and by Tartuffe, the moral censor of the house. There are two children by the first marriage. Damis, a violent young boy, foot-stamping sort of person. Then Marianne, who is a sort of spinelessly good young woman, a great reader of romantic novels. Marianne has a lady's maid who is my favorite character in the play, was, I suspect, a peasant girl, but very bright and perfectly orthodox in all her attitudes, but, you know, brightly orthodox. She sees everything clearly and puts it wittily. The last character I have to mention, I'm afraid this is getting to be a lot of people, the last character I have to mention is Cléant, who is Orgon's brother-in-law, Elmire's brother. And he's a sensible, worldly man who has what I think Molière would approve of as a commonsensical sort of religious faith. Most of what Cléant says, I believe we are to trust. Although one of the jokes of the play is that for all of Cléant's talking, and he has enormous long tirades to get off, he accomplishes nothing. Nobody ever does anything that he suggests. Well, the first scene of the play consists of Madame Pernel's that is to say, Orgon's old mothers, telling off all the children of the family for their moral failings. At the end of that scene, most of the family escort Madame Pernelle to the door to see her off. Cléant, the brother-in-law, the raisonneur of the play, lingers behind with Doreen, the lady's maid. And Cléant says, "I think I'll stay behind. I want no further pieces of her mind. How that old lady, Doreen? Oh, what wouldn't she say if she could hear you speak of her that way? She'd thank you for the lady, but I'm sure she'd find the old a little premature." Cléant, "My, what a scene she made, and what a din. And how this man Tartuffe has taken her in." Doreen, "Yes, but her son is even worse deceived. His folly must be seen to be believed. In the late troubles he played an able part and served his king with wise and loyal heart, but he's quite lost his senses since he fell beneath Tartuffe's infatuating spell. He calls him brother and loves him as his life, preferring him to mother, child, or wife. In him and him alone will he confide. He's made him his confessor and his guide. He pets and pampers him with love more tender than any pretty mistress could engender, gives him the place of honor when they dine, delights to see him gorging like a swine, stuffs him with dainties till his guts distend, and when he belches, cries, 'God bless you, friend.' In short, he's mad. He worships him. He dotes. His deeds he marvels at, his words he quotes, thinking each act a miracle, each word oracular as those that Moses heard. Tartuffe, much pleased to find so easy a victim, has in 100 ways beguiled and tricked him, milked him of money, and with his permission established here a sort of inquisition. Even Laurent, his lackey, dares to give us arrogant advice on how to live. He sermonizes us in thundering tones and confiscates our ribbons and colognes. Last week he tore a kerchief into pieces because he found it pressed in a life of Jesus. He said it was a sin to juxtapose unholy vanities and holy prose." I can't handle the scenes which immediately follow, but in one of them, Orgon, coming back presumably from some business trip to the country, exposes to his brother-in-law Cléant and to Doreen the full extent of his folly. He exposes the extent to which he can think only of Tartuffe, on whom he has really a most unwholesome kind of crush, and also the extent to which he's withdrawn all natural feeling from his wife and the other members of his family. He's so preposterous that as she leaves, Doreen, the lady's maid, makes a joke at his expense, which he doesn't even recognize as such. Whereupon Cléant says to his brother-in-law, "That girl was laughing in your face, and though I've no wish to offend you, even so I'm bound to say that she had some excuse. How can you possibly be such a goose? Are you so dazed by this man's hocus-pocus that all the world save him is out of focus? You've given him clothing, shelter, food, and care. Why must you also..." Orgon, Brother, stop right there. You do not know the man of whom you speak." Cléant, "I grant you that. But my judgment's not so weak that I can't tell by his effect on others." Orgon, "Ah, when you meet him, you two will be like brothers. There's been no loftier soul since time began. He is an excellent man. To keep his precepts is to be reborn and view this dunghill of a world with scorn. Yes, thanks to him, I'm a changed man indeed. Under his tutelage, my soul's been freed of earthly loves and every human tie. My mother, children, brother, and wife could die, and I'd not feel a single moment's pain." Cléant, "That's a fine sentiment, brother, most humane." Orgon, "Oh, had you seen Tartuffe as I first knew him, your heart, like mine, would have surrendered to him. He used to come into our church each day and humbly kneel nearby and start to pray. He'd draw the eyes of everybody there by the deep fervor of his heartfelt prayer. He'd sigh and weep, and sometimes with a sound of rapture he would bend and kiss the ground. And when I rose to go, he'd run before to offer me holy water at the door. His serving man, no less devout than he, informed me of his master's poverty. I gave him gifts, but in his humbleness he'd beg me every time to give him less. 'Oh, that's too much,' he'd cry, 'too much by twice. I don't deserve it. The half, sir, would suffice.' And when I wouldn't take it back, he'd share half of it with the poor, right then and there. At length, Heaven prompted me to take him in to dwell with us and free our souls from sin. He guides our lives, and to protect my honor, stays by my wife and keeps an eye upon her. He tells me whom she sees and all she does, and seems more jealous than I ever was. And how austere he is. Why, he can detect a mortal sin where you would least suspect. In smallest trifles, he's extremely strict. Last week, his conscience was severely pricked because, while praying, he had caught a flea and killed it, so he felt, too wrathfully. Finally, I'd like to read you the early part of Act 3, chief event between the little passages I've read you here and the beginning of Act 3, is that Orgon, annoyed by his family's resistance to Tartuffe, decides to cancel Marianne's engagement to a nice, eligible young bourgeois named Valère and bestow her instead on Tartuffe. The family, of course, all find this a loathsome idea, and they begin to combine against the plan. Elmire is more or less delegated to lead the offensive against this project, to talk to Orgon and to talk to Tartuffe and try to talk them out of it. Now, as Act 3 begins, Doreen is standing here in the middle of the stage, down front in one, as they say, and there's a staircase behind her. She's waiting at the bottom of the stairs for Tartuffe to come down so that she can invite him to have a conversation with Elmire and be talked out of any marriage with Marianne. Damis, the choleric son, now comes on stage, and he's as always in a bad temper. He's particularly in a bad temper because he wanted to marry Valère's sister, you see. And if one match is off, the other match is going to be off too. So on he comes. May lightning strike me even as I speak. May all men call me cowardly and weak if any fear or scruple holds me back from settling things at once with that great quack. Doreen, now don't give way to violent emotion. Your father's merely talked about this notion, and words and deeds are far from being one. Much that is talked about is left undone. Damis, no. I must stop this scoundrel's machinations. I'll go and tell him off. I'm out of patience. Doreen, do calm down and be practical. I had rather my mistress dealt with him and with your father. She has some influence with Tartuffe, I've noted. He hangs upon her word, seems most devoted, and may indeed be smitten by her charm. Pray heaven it's true. 'Twould do our cause no harm. She sent for him just now to sound him out on this affair you're so incensed about. She'll find out where he stands. And tell him, too, what dreadful strife and trouble will ensue if he lends countenance to your father's plan. I couldn't get in to see him, but his man says that he's almost finished with his prayers. Go now. I'll catch him when he comes downstairs. Damis, I want to hear this conference, and I will. Doreen, no, they must be alone. Damis, oh, I'll keep still. Doreen, not you. I know your temper. You'd start a brawl and shout and stamp your foot and spoil it all. Go on. Damis, I won't. I have a perfect right. Doreen, Lord, you're a nuisance. He's coming. Get out of sight. So Damis goes and hides in a closet, you know, somewhere toward the rear of the stage. And now Tartuffe comes down the stair, and he observes Doreen below. And he either addresses his manservant off stage or pretends to. It doesn't matter. What he's saying is for the benefit of Doreen and for anybody else who might be listening. Hang up my hair shirt. Put my scourge in place, and pray, Laurent, for heaven's perpetual grace. I'm going to the prison now to share my last few coins with the poor wretches there. Doreen, aside, dear God, what affectation, what a fake. Tartuffe, you wish to see me? Doreen, yes. Tartuffe, taking a handkerchief from his pocket, for mercy's sake, please take this handkerchief before you speak. Doreen, what? Tartuffe, cover that bosom, girl. The flesh is weak, and unclean thoughts are difficult to control. Such sights as that can undermine the soul. Doreen, your soul, it seems, has very poor defenses. And flesh makes quite an impact on your senses. It's strange that you're so easily excited. My own desires are not so soon ignited, and if I saw you naked as a beast, not all your hide would tempt me in the least. Tartuffe, girl, speak more modestly. Unless you do, I shall be forced to take my leave of you. Doreen, oh no, it's I who must be on my way. I've just one little message to convey. Madame is coming down and begs you, sir, to wait and have a word or two with her. Tartuffe, gladly. Doreen, aside, that had a softening effect. I think my guess about him was correct. Tartuffe, will she be long? Doreen, no, that's her step, I hear. Ah, here she is, and I shall disappear. Doreen trips off, and Elmire starts coming down the staircase, and Tartuffe turns toward her, holding out his arms, I imagine, and making a speech in which you hear disturbing echoes of the Book of Common Prayer. May heaven, whose infinite goodness we adore, preserve your body and soul forevermore, and bless your days, and answer thus the plea of one who is its humblest votary. Elmire, I thank you for that pious wish, but please do take a chair, and let's be more at ease. They sit down. Tartuffe, I trust that you are once more well and strong. Elmire, oh yes, the fever didn't last for long. Tartuffe, my prayers are too unworthy, I am sure, to have gained from heaven this most gracious cure. But lately, madam, my every supplication has had for object your recuperation. Elmire, you shouldn't have troubled so. I don't deserve it. Tartuffe, your health is priceless, madam, and to preserve it, I'd gladly give my own in all sincerity. Elmire, sir, you outdo us all in Christian charity. You've been most kind. I count myself your debtor. Tartuffe, 'twas nothing, madam. I long to serve you better. Elmire, there's a private matter I'm anxious to discuss. I'm glad there's no one here to hinder us. Tartuffe, I too am glad. It floods my heart with bliss to find myself alone with you like this. For just this chance I've prayed with all my power, but prayed in vain until this happy hour. Elmire, this won't take long, sir, and I hope you'll be entirely frank and unconstrained with me. Tartuffe, indeed there's nothing I had rather do than bear my inmost heart and soul to you. First, let me say that what remarks I've made about the constant visits you are paid were prompted not by any mean emotion, but rather by a pure and deep devotion, a fervent zeal. Elmire, no need for explanation. Your sole concern, I'm sure, was my salvation. Tartuffe, taking Elmire's hand and pressing her fingertips, quite so, and such great fervor do I feel. Elmire, ooh, please, you're pinching. Tartuffe, 'twas from excess of zeal. I never meant to cause you pain, I swear. I'd rather... Here he places his hand on Elmire's knee. Elmire, what can your hand be doing there? Tartuffe, feeling your gown. What soft, fine woven stuff. Elmire, please, I'm extremely ticklish. That's enough. She pulls her chair away, and Tartuffe pulls his chair after her, and he begins to fondle the lace collar of her gown, and he says... My, what lovely lacework on your dress. The workmanship's miraculous, no less. I've not seen anything to equal it. Elmire, yes, quite. But let's talk business for a bit. They say my husband means to break his word and give his daughter to you, sir. Had you heard? Tartuffe, he did once mention it. But I confess I dream of quite a different happiness. It's elsewhere, madam, that my eyes discern the promise of that bliss for which I yearn. Elmire, I see you care for nothing here below. Tartuffe, ah, well, my heart's not made of stone, you know. Elmire, all your desires mount heavenward, I'm sure, in scorn of all that's earthly and impure. Tartuffe, a love of heavenly beauty does not preclude a proper love for earthly pulchritude. Our senses are quite rightly captivated by perfect works our Maker has created. Some glory clings to all that heaven has made. In you, all heaven's marvels are displayed. On that fair face, such beauties have been lavished, the eyes are dazzled and the heart is ravished. How could I look on you, O flawless creature, and not adore the author of all nature, feeling a love both passionate and pure for you, his triumph of self-portraiture? At first I trembled lest that love should be a subtle snare that hell had laid for me. I vowed to flee the sight of you, eschewing a rapture that might prove my soul's undoing. But soon, fair being, I became aware that my deep passion could be made to square with rectitude and with my bounden duty. I thereupon surrendered to your beauty. It is, I know, presumptuous on my part to bring you this poor offering of my heart, and it is not my merit, heaven knows, but your compassion on which my hopes repose. You are my peace, my solace, my salvation. On you depends my bliss or desolation. I bide your judgment, and as you think best, I shall be either miserable or blessed. Elmire, your declaration is most gallant, sir, but don't you think it's out of character? You'd have done better to restrain your passion and think before you spoke in such a fashion. It ill becomes a pious man like you. Tartuffe, I may be pious, but I'm human too. With your celestial charms before his eyes, a man has not the power to be wise. I know such words sound strangely coming from me, but I'm no angel, nor was meant to be. And if you blame my passion, you must needs reproach as well the charms on which it feeds. Your loveliness I had no sooner seen than you became my soul's unrivaled queen. Before your seraph glance, divinely sweet, my heart's defenses crumbled in defeat, and nothing fasting, prayer, or tears might do could stay my spirit from adoring you. My eyes, my sighs have told you in the past what now my lips make bold to say at last. And if in your great goodness you will deign to look upon your slave and ease his pain, if in compassion for my soul's distress you'll stoop to comfort my unworthiness, I'll raise to you, in thanks for that sweet manna, an endless hymn, an infinite hosanna. With me, of course, there need be no anxiety, no fear of scandal or of notoriety. These young court gallants whom all the ladies fancy are vain in speech, in action rash and chancy. When they succeed in love, the world soon knows it. No favors granted them, but they disclose it, and by the looseness of their tongues profane the very altar where their hearts have lain. Men of my sort, however, love discreetly, and one may trust our reticence completely. My keen concern for my good name ensures the absolute security of yours. In short, I offer you, my dear Elmire, love without scandal, pleasure without fear. I realize I'm running on a bit, but I'd like to finish with a few new poems, a few poems that haven't yet appeared in book form. Here's my latest. I don't know. This one is called In a Churchyard, and I've never read this aloud to anybody before. Let's see how it sounds. One is in a churchyard, and because one is in a churchyard, one is thinking of Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard, especially that business about gems and flowers, you know, full many a... one starts thinking of that. That flower unseen, that gem of purest ray, bright thoughts uncut by men. Strange that you need but speak them, Thomas Gray, and the mind skips and dives beyond its ken, finding at once the wild supposed bloom, or in the imagined cave some pulse of crystal staving off the gloom, as covertly as phosphorus in a grave. Void notions proper to a buried head. Beneath these tombstones here, unseenness fills the sockets of the dead, whatever to their souls may now appear. And who but those unfathomably deaf who quiet all this ground could catch within the ear's diminished clef a music innocent of time and sound? What do the living hear then when the bell hangs plumb within the tower of the still church, and still their thoughts compel pure tollings that intend no mortal hour? As when a ferry for the shore of death glides looming toward the dock, her engines cut, her spirits bating breath, as the ranked pillars narrow toward the shock. So memory and expectation set some pulseless clangor free of circumstance and charm us to forget this twilight crumbling in the churchyard tree. Those swifts or swallows which do not pertain, scuffed voices in the drive, that light flicked on behind the vestry pane, till unperplexed from all that is alive, it shadows all our thought, balked imminence of uncommitted sound, and still would tower at the sill of sense, were not, as now, its honed abeyance crowned with a mauled boom of summons, far more strange than any stroke unheard, which breaks again with unimagined range through all reverberations of the word, pooling the mystery of things that are, the buzz of prayer said, the scent of grass, the earliest blooming star, these unseen gravestones, and the darker dead. I don't know how clear that is. It's probably rather obscure. No obscurer than the minds of the voters of California, though, is it? Here's another new poem called Under Cygnus, and there is some astronomical information behind it, which I secured this summer from a little $1 Simon & Schuster book. I was pleased to find that that Northern Cross, Swan, and Sword are three different names for the same constellation. And the other thing that goes into this poem and exhausts my astronomical knowledge is the fact that while our solar system is heading at all times for Hercules, for the constellation Hercules, it's diverted from it by the rotation of the galaxy in the direction of the Northern Cross. Well, all right. This is called Under Cygnus. Who says I shall not straighten till I bend, and must be broken if I hope to mend? Did Samson gain by being chained and blind? Dark heaven hints at something of the kind, seeing that as we beat toward Hercules, our flank is compassed by the galaxies, and we drawn off from our intended course by a grand reel of stars, whose banded force, catching us up, makes light of all our loss, and dances us into the Northern Cross. Well, if I must surrender and be gay in the wrong pasture of the Milky Way, if in the cross I must resign my sword to hang among the trophies of the Lord, let my distinction not consist alone in having let myself be overthrown. It was my loves and labors carried high which drove the flight that heaven turns awry, my dreams which told the stars what they should tell. Let the swan, dying, sing of that as well. Here's a little poem called The Proof. I think I must read just two more. This is a little one, and then I'll close with an interminable one. For those who have never corrected galley proof, I should say that when you delete something from a text then decide that after all you'd like to keep it, you write in the margin stet, meaning let it stand. The proof. Shall I love God for causing me to be? I was mere utterance. Shall these words love me? Yet when I caused his work to jar and stammer, and one free subject loosened all his grammar, I love him that he did not in a rage once and forever rule me off the page. But thinking I might come to please him yet, crossed out delete and wrote his patient stet. My last one is called On the Marginal Way, and it's a poem situated in a place many of you may know. Any of you who know Ogunquit, Maine, will know the coastal ramble I'm talking about. a wonderful path which leads you past many coves, one of which fascinated me when I was last there because it was full of a different kind of rock, flesh-colored rock, limestone-ish looking rock, you know, and very, very rounded in a Henry Moore manner, suggestive of human figures. And, well, this is a poem in which just anybody walking along such a coastal walk, across what I am told are the oldest coastal rocks in the continent. They have no fossil remains in them. With his head full of the news, might make of such a cove. I met a while ago a semi-abstract painter named Murphy, and he told me a story which I thought was a dreadful commentary on the contemporary mind. He's been, with no pornographic intent whatever, he has been painting semi-abstract pictures of lovemaking. And like so many painters, you know, he's been doing the same subject over and over again. He has a studio full of these canvases. He said that some people came to see his work not long ago, and one of his visitors stepped to the center of the studio, spun about, and said, "My God, what is this, Dachau? Isn't it too bad when pictures of when the nude body can suggest nothing better than Dachau?" On the marginal way, another cove of shale, but the beach here is rubbled with strange rock that is sleek, fluent, and taffy pale. I stare, reminded with a little shock how by a shore in Spain George Borrow saw 100 women basking in the raw. They must have looked like this, that catch of bodies on the sand, that strew of rondure, crease, and orifice, lap, flank, and knee, a too abundant view, which, though he'd had the lenses of a fly, could not have waked desire in Borrow's eye. Has the light altered now? The rocks flush rose and have the melting shape of bodies fallen anyhow. It is a Jericho of blood and rape, some desert town despoiled, some caravan pillaged, its people murdered to a man, and those who murdered them galloping off, a rumpling line of dust like the waves' white withdrawing hem. But now the vision of a colder lust clears as the wind goes chill, and all is grayed by a swift cloud that drags a carrion shade. If these are bodies still, theirs is a death too dead to look asleep, like that of Auschwitz's final kill, poor slaty flesh, abandoned in a heap, and then, like sea rocks buried by a wave, bulldozed at last into a common grave. It is not tricks of sense, but the time's fright within me which distracts least fancies into violence and makes my thought take cover in the facts, as now it does, remembering how the bed of layered rock 2 miles above my head hove ages up and broke soundless asunder when the shrinking skin of earth blacked out by steam and smoke, gave passage to the muddled fire within, its crannies flooding with a sweat of quartz, and lathered magmas out of deep retorts welled up, as here, to fill with tumbled rock meal, stone fume, lithic spray, the dike's brief chasm and the sill. Weathered until the sixth and human day by sanding winds and water, scuffed and brayed by the slow glacier's heel, these forms were made that now recline and burn, comely as Eve and Adam, near a sea transfigured by the sun's return. And now 3 girls lie golden in the lee of a great arm or thigh, and are as young as the bright boulders that they lie among. Though high above the shore on someone's porch, spread wings of newsprint flap the tidings of some dirty war, it is a perfect day. The waters clap their hands and kindle, and the gull in flight loses himself at moments, white in white, and like a breaking thought, joy for a moment floods into the mind, blurting that all things shall be brought to the full state and stature of their kind by what has found the manhood of this stone. May that vast motive wash and wash our own. Thank you.